You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. Today I'm joined by Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hi there, Julie.
And Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Julie.
Great to have your company. We want to discuss Tom Stoppard, the brilliant Tom Stoppard, who died November 29 last year. And we didn't want to pass up the opportunity to geek out a little bit about his plays and his work more in general. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, more specifically.
Spoilers.
Are they, though?
Are they even? I wanted to start just very generally. I mean, his plays. So, Sam, have you ever seen one live?
No, to my great shame, Tom Stoppard was a name that I was familiar with, but mostly from his work on screenplays. So I knew that he had written, you know, or helped write Brazil, Empire of the Sun, The Russia House, Shakespeare in Love, Enigma. I think I was aware of him as a screenwriter. And then in my English studies, I happened to come across a couple of his plays, Arcadia in particular, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead as well. And I remember writing an assignment on Arcadia, even though I don't remember the play, but I reread the assignment for this podcast. And I was like, okay, I guess I knew some Stoppard at one point, but that's such a long time ago. So no, this was also the reason why I wanted to join this podcast to, you know, to educate myself on the playwright Stoppard, and particularly that play.
Yeah, I'm no expert. Maybe Matt. Matt, will you educate us both?
I wouldn't call myself an expert, definitely not. And it's been a long time since I did any Tom Stoppard in detail. I think like Sam, I was aware of the screenplays first. Although my mother actually had Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the book of the play, in her collection. And we never talked about it, I think, but based on when the play was first put on stage, I could imagine she saw one of the earliest productions in the UK at the time. But as I said, never talked to her about it. I tried to read the book at the time, but didn't get anything. So I'm talking about really early teens. Also because I didn't know anything much about Hamlet. I saw the film probably first in my late teens, early 20s. It was one of those films that probably Sky Movies bought cheaply. So they basically could show it usually at a time when no one watched TV except for the terminally insomniacs like me. I'm pretty sure, though, I saw Terry Gilliam's Brazil first. And I think that's when I first got an idea of, okay, Tom Stoppard, what is his writing style like? Although, of course, my first unconscious encounter would have been Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, where he was, I think, the script doctor. I'm not sure he's even in the credits, but he definitely worked on that script. Once at uni, I read a number of his plays in our drama workshop. We also did a couple of the short plays just as practice, as kind of for ourselves. Later on, I did teach Arcadia. And I've seen Arcadia performed by a German amateur troupe, kind of student theater, which was fantastic. I also saw it at the West End, and I've forgotten everything about it, so it must not have been a very good production. And I've seen Rosencrantz and Guildenstern performed at the Fringe in Edinburgh.
Ah, well, I don't know if it's unlucky or just unattentive, but I've never seen one actually performed. So my knowledge of Stoppard's plays mainly comes straight from the page. I just cracked open the book and read the play. And I have to say, Arcadia does lend itself to that. It's very evocative and it's very, very shattering straight from the page. And later, there were radio plays of Stoppard's work. I sent you some of them in preparation for this pod that are some of my favorites, the BBC, which is lovely because you can just revisit them at your leisure with a cup of hot chocolate and lots of marshmallows and listen to them. Not all of them are particularly successful. I had one Rosencrantz and Guildenstern version. I don't remember who put it out, but that was very stagey and very sort of a bit overblown, if that makes sense. And I think the text of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead sort of risks that with its very sort of semi-philosophical, half-existentialist sort of themes that people tend to, I don't know, it's like any author quoting Shakespeare. They always start to get this tone in their voice because it's Shakespeare. I think it's a little bit the same with Stoppard. So I don't know much about them except straight from the page and the film of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which we will get to a little bit later, but I rather love. So is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern a favorite, or do you have others that you particularly love?
It's definitely one of my favorites. Arcadia is very, very good. But I have to say, I'm a big fan of clever, witty, well-done meta-fiction and meta-theater. So obviously the meta element is big in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Plus, it's the first one I've seen as a film in this case. And I also think that the film does some things really well. I mean, if you look at Arcadia, it's also funny and it's also witty. But I like the clownesque element of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern a lot. So I would say it is a favorite. Some of the later plays of his have not come alive to me like those two, Arcadia and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, have come.
Well, I have few plays to compare it to, right? Because it's kind of the one that I now have revisited for the pod, and Arcadia is more like a distant memory. So it's hard for me to compare it to others, but I certainly went through the different stages of being puzzled by the play, finding a way into the play through the film, and then through the radio play that I listened to in preparation. So I would say a process to dive into it more deeply. It doesn't lend itself right away. So I had this kind of probably teenage first reaction to it where I didn't get anything at all and was kind of put off by it, especially on the page. I was quite tedious to read first time around. But then I think the performance really played a role. Both the filmic and the radio performance really opened the play up in stages. But it's definitely one that has layers and layers to get into. And if you're put off by the kind of pointlessness and the kind of intentional boredom, existentialism that is created from the very beginning, then, you know, you're never going to get there. So you have to be patient, right?
Well, then, giving me a great bridge, Sam. What do you think it's about? So summarize, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, just in a few sentences. What is it about?
Oh God, what an involved question. At first I thought it was about nothing, right? I mean, the whole point was about pointlessness and running in circles and characters that are not characters and stuff that is happening that is not really happening. Someone is dying and is not really dying. So at first I thought, okay, it's just absurd to the point of like repetitive. And I didn't quite get, obviously there's the Hamlet plot that goes along with it, but I enjoyed it little. And then I think on second watching the film now, I kind of got into the humor of it. The two, you know, Laurel and Hardy type main characters that are supposedly funny at first and have their identity crisis and then find their role and their characters and identities in the course of the play, or they don't. So I enjoyed the playfulness of it and obviously the actors playing those roles. And I think only the radio play, because you have such a focus on what they actually say and how they say it. And you hear the text again the third time round. I kind of got more into the philosophical aspect of it, you know, the nature of death, the nature of the theater or of reality. Yeah, it goes into very, very deep topics in a playful, witty way. And it also made much more sense to me the way the side characters are put at the center and juxtaposed with what's happening to Hamlet and the people in Shakespeare's play. So really, it's like, you know, blossoming the more you think about it. That was my short take.
Matt, what
is it all about when you get right down to it?
Death. No, perhaps in three sentences, I would say, obviously, to some extent, this is Hamlet from the perspective of two marginal characters, but it is just as much a riff on Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. It's about two clownish characters who don't know, but come to understand that their lives have already been written, and therefore their deaths as well. And we see them struggling with the absurdist challenge of being minor, underwritten, and finally unimportant.
I suppose I have to go too now that put you both on the grill. I think if I had to explain Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, I'd start with Hamlet, because Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are introduced, I think, in Act 2, Scene 2 of Hamlet. And I think the play is best understood as that Hamlet, or the mother play, let's say, gives us the timeline of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's life and fate. They have no idea what they're geared towards, but we do, right? And then you get into, ultimately, these characters are not the protagonist of their own story. And we always love to imagine ourselves to be the protagonist of our story. But what if we weren't and we didn't even know? So that gives some of the depth to me. And it's a great play on words. There are so many great monologues and dialogues. it's lovely to just listen to. And again, yeah, the philosophy, I think this is a long time ago for me, but I think we get into Camus with life is absurd. And the only way to defy that is to sort of go with that life is absurd, defy the fact that it's absurd. You are in this absurd existence and you don't know what the point is. But the point is not wondering what the point is. The point is to make a point for yourself. And I'm starting to sound like an ancillary character in a play. Anyway, let's go straight into the film's way of putting the play. It's a little bit different, isn't it? I mean, did you, either of you notice or were put off by some of the changes that were made?
Hard to say, because as I said, it was such a struggle to get into the text for me. So I was just like very relieved of being able to see it, you know, played out, to see the different connections, because the whole setup of them being in a place yet not being in a place and being inside reality, but then also being inside a play within a play within the play, I think I needed to somehow see that visualized for me. I felt quite stupid reading it because I was going through pages and pages and pages and thought, okay, yeah, I get this is from Hamlet and this is absurdist and I see Beckett, the inspiration and so on. But I really did not know where this was going and what this was supposed to tell me. I guess the wit, you know, was on the page, but I guess I must have started like reading through it quite quickly because I didn't enjoy it, right? So I was really happy to see the film play out. And then this landscape comes up, right? It looks like it's a Western, but I think it's former Yugoslavia somewhere, the landscape where it was filmed. And those two characters show up. And then Tim Roth and Gary Oldman are fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, really enjoyed their performance. Seeing them as rather young actors was very enjoyable as well. So I think the film took me in right away by just their good performance and by having these lines said by good actors. And I think the rest of the ensemble, including Richard Dreyfuss and a couple of the Game of Thrones alumni that are in there, were very enjoyable. And I particularly thought Hamlet was very strong as well in the film version. So yeah, it came alive through the setting, through the exteriors and interiors, and particularly through, you know, capable people really living out that text and giving it the wit and the meaning, the tragedy and the absurdism from the start.
Matt, what did you think?
I definitely think that the film does a tremendous job of staging, so to speak, the play. And I do think it is one that's very difficult to get into if you just read it. As I said, when I read it first, it was too early for me. I didn't get anything. Luckily, I just thought, yeah, well, I don't get it. Perhaps I'll come back to this in 10 years' time. And that was okay. And then I saw the film. I think it shows that the actors obviously understand how this works, how the verbal humor works. You've got this repartee, this back and forth, this kind of metaphorical tennis game almost. And I think these rhythms, they don't jump off the page. They jump off the screen, though, and off the stage, obviously, if done well. And Stoppard, obviously, directing the film himself, he knows how he meant this to work, how he meant the rhythm to be. And I think that also shows. I could imagine that Tim Roth and Gary Oldman themselves might have been confused at first, but they worked with the director who obviously knew how this was supposed to click. And I think that very much does then click. Better than in the other productions that I've seen. I would not necessarily myself say, ah, well, you know, what are the differences from play to film? Because most of the differences to the published version of the play are not miles away from what you might find in any production of any play. You know, lines being cut, things being moved around. That is relatively normal, but it does do certain things that you couldn't do in this way on stage. Like, the film has this M.C. Escher quality almost, you know, the castle once they get to basically the Danish court. It's a bit like, as I said, an M.C. Escher kind of space where people can leave on the left and enter to the right. And it's a maze, but it's a maze that's impossible. A bit like the Pac-Man maze, actually. So perhaps Pac-Man is also a take on Hamlet. And there's also certain ways of basically in which the editing is used quite clever. You know, for instance, in Hamlet, you've got the play within the play. And in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you've got the play within the play within the play. And it being film, you can cut directly from the puppet show, which is the play within the play within the play, to basically the first level. So from the third level to the first level to the Hamlet story itself, which you couldn't do exactly like that on stage. But on the whole, I think it is very much a film production that while In terms of cinematography, it does do some things that only film can do. It is very much informed by what you might do on stage. And I think it's quite close from what I've read to Stoppard's own original production.
Yeah, he said about that, the editor and so on, that nobody would dare cut as much from his play as he would. And that was probably a good thing that he left like miles and reams and reams and reams by the wayside. Yeah.
I was very curious about how the film would work with the theatrical effects, because I think it's such a play that is meant to be played on a stage, right? And then use the different parts of the stage and the different exit and entrances and the trap doors and so on to create effect. So I thought maybe a film would maybe open that up too much to make it seem too real, almost the places, the locations, like actual castles. And I think part of the charm or the interest, I guess, is to kind of be disoriented where that even takes place and where these cuts and changes take place. But I think the editing works really well in the film. At one particular one, I think it was towards the end, where you see the back of the coach that carries the Renaissance theater away from the screen. And you're kind of like out of the scene and they close the door at the back and the horse carriage just takes it away. And I think there's some really clever things that the film did to play with those levels of realism, reality or not, theater or not, that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I think there's something to the sometimes a quibble that film critics have, that it constrains the play to a reality that might be too grounding for it, right? I feel that too, in a way, is that they use all these cute little gimmicks, which I love and I wouldn't want to miss for the world, like, you know, Gary Oldman making a hamburger. Like, just incidentally, that's just hilarious to me. It has nothing to do with the play, but he just invents the hamburger in the middle of it, which, yeah, I just adore that. That's great stuff. But I can imagine people thinking, okay, this is just too constrictive. And for instance, the audio production has a little bit more freedom, as Matt alluded to, like this badminton match somehow taking place behind the scenes and Hamlet just passing through as one incident follows another, or maybe one murder follows another, and everybody is running towards their doom at like heart-stopping pace, and then Gary Oldman just invented the hamburger. I think that is just a level of funny that I don't see any other film doing.
Yeah, and I think also the choice of places, locations that they have in there, they all seem a little unreal. So starting with this kind of Western stony landscape at the beginning, where they're kind of in no man's land, to also the interior, some of these very Eastern European looking halls that are supposed to be in at the Danish court, or obviously the ship and the roads and so on. It's very well chosen, I think. Also the fact that with Tom Stoppard's background in Eastern Europe, that they chose to go to Croatia, I think. And at the time, you know, 1990, I think just such an interesting time as well. If you thought of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of somehow being subject, ruled by forces way above their heads, you know, this authorities way above them. It's interesting that it was set in a kind of authoritarian society, but I'm not sure if that was the whole point. Was there a point? Or wasn't there? But it certainly made for a very nice setting.
I mean, the thing is, the authority that they struggle against is that of the written word, or it is that of the playwright. It is that of the author. And I'm not sure, you know, I think you could probably do this in a way that highlighted how, you know, sometimes the author is the state or the authoritarian state. I don't think in this production that's necessarily there. You know, you have lines like, who decides it is written. And I think it is kind of more metaphysical than that. I don't think the play necessarily would work if you read it too politically, but I think it works if you read it very much metaphysically. I think for me, it's also when I first saw it, it evoked many of the same feelings as, for instance, The Truman Show, which, you know, sometimes is read quite narrowly as a comment on, you know, the emergence of reality TV, which I don't think it is. It's about someone whose story is basically told by outside forces, and he starts to realize, hang on, don't I have agency? And struggling against the author in order to have agency. I think that is very much, for me, the story that is told here. In The Truman Show, it ends with the actor, so to speak, realizing what his role is and escaping it. in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, it ends with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern realizing that the only escape, if it is an escape, is death.
I read this a little bit. I don't know. There's this thing in philosophy, like in our Western philosophy, is that we are cogs or characters as living things in this story written by God. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, to me, gives a big fat raspberry to that idea. If you are a character in a story that is written, what does that mean? What does that make you, right? So in that sense, we go back to the fact, my opinion, that it's an existentialist play in the sense that if the question then becomes your story is written, then how, like alluded to with Camus earlier, how do we then deal with, do we even know what we're in? Because Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, they don't. They keep trying to make sense of something we as the audience know is already set in stone. And to Sam's point, the Berlin Wall fell in 89, which I always think is interesting as the film was made in 1990. Does that somehow inform this play on any other level than an emotional one? I don't know, but it's an interesting thought. How do we look at the forces that move us forward in life? And are they determinist? Or do we in fact have a choice? Because if you know your Hamlet really well, there is a thing about a letter that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern get into their possession. And that letter is switched in the play of Hamlet. And that letter leads them to their death. But in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, they read this letter. So the original letter that is later switched. And that letter says that Hamlet is to be killed. But they don't do anything to help Hamlet. And then the letter is switched. They go on the ship. They end up in England. And the letter says Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are to be executed. And then Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. So there is a problem of choice in this film or in the play, in that you are meant to think they have no choice. They just run along with the play until they are, in fact, dead. But there is a problem in the middle there somewhere where they could have said no, as they quote at the very end. What do you think? Push back on me a little bit here with my rambling.
Well, I think one thing there is, yes, they could have chosen to do something about the letter, but would it have changed anything about the outcome? Because whether that letter says, you know, Hamlet is to be put to death or not, it's what Hamlet wants. It's also what Hamlet, in a way, needs to happen to him. I do think that, you know, their choice might not have changed anything. We don't see anything that indicates it would have changed anything. Whereas I think we see a lot of, you know, from the beginning, heads. They're introduced by, you know, their spinning coins and it always comes up heads, which I think very, very much indicates that what we are looking at here is a very deterministic universe, but it is one in which we can struggle against determinism and that struggle might mean something, but it doesn't change the eventual outcome.
So they have no choice. Sam, do you agree? No choice?
I'm trying to think, you know, because obviously there's that scene where they ponder about what they could do, right? Once they have read the letter and they read about Hamlet's fate. So there's that possibility where they could do something and they choose not to. So there is choice, but it is also written again, right? Both those letters are written. So I think there's at least a small joke on that as well. The whole it is written thing, you know, it reminds me also, or reminded me also of, I don't know, the Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston, you know, it is written. So the biblical determinism of a larger power. But also, of course, this, I mean, you mentioned the meta theater aspect, also the joke on the fact that Shakespeare play is already written. And Stoppard has also written it in a certain way that they're just like washed along by something that is already in the page, but they're not aware of it. I think a lot of the humor is in that sense of loss, right? Where obviously, who are we? Who is who? Some characters seem to understand that it is written. So they know that it's going to work out a certain way, but they're not really aware of it. They don't know the play and the audience does. So it's, I mean, that drives the whole. A play that doesn't move forward is driven forward by this ignorance or this being in the middle and not choosing. So is that a choice?
And I mean, it's just before we get to the scene with the letter, we have kind of the comedic version of exactly the same dilemma. It's when they realize they're on a boat. And I think it's Rosencrantz who says, you know, I'll just jump over the side. That'll put a spanner in their works. And Guildenstern says, perhaps that's exactly what they expect you to do. So Rosencrantz goes like, I'll stay right here. That'll put a spanner in their works. So I think that's the thing. They, at this point, I think, have gotten enough of an impression that whatever they do, they are following a script. So even choice seems to follow a script. Everything that they've seen indicates that it all follows a script. So I understand them basically distrusting choice because they have no idea whether it is true choice, whether it is real choice.
Right, exactly. And how would you know?
Absolutely. And I think we probably need to bring the player into this because so far we've talked about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who, as the title says, are dead from the beginning. But we've got the player, so the leader of this troop of actors that goes and performs the murder of Gonzago. So he is different. They are different. They seem to understand something about all of this that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and in the end, Hamlet and Polonius and co. don't seem to get. So what do you do with the player? What's his role in all of this?
That's another big hard question, because, I mean, he also changes identities just like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern do, right? In the course of the play, that the troupe of actors take up different roles, changing from the troupe of actors to the actual characters in the Shakespeare play. So I was a bit lost at the beginning. And again, the film helped, the radio play helped to identify the player and what's his role. I think at the beginning, he seems like a master of ceremony to me. He's also the one who brings a couple of the first body moments into the play when he introduces all the options of what they could put on stage, you know, all the genres, all the types of plays. When he introduces Alfred, the young actor who plays the female roles, and he makes all these terrible jokes about what they could perform and in what way and in what distribution of roles. I mean, it was first like entertaining to have him speak, but then obviously he's the one who responds or doesn't respond in an understandable way to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of, you know, who they are, where they are at, what their role at the court is supposed to be, and starts off their reflections on what they have heard from him, and obviously shows up throughout the play at different stages, especially also towards the end. So yeah, he's chameleonic in his role, but definitely has a big influence on, like we said before, the fact that what is written, what is determined, is mentioned by him, is brought in as something to reflect upon between Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in their scenes that follow, if that makes sense.
In a very real way, the player is perhaps more of a protagonist in terms of agency than Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are, because the player understands what's going on to an extent, as Matt rightly puts it, that even Hamlet doesn't. So the player understands that this is absurd, that this is a play, will play itself out. As he says, I can't remember the quote verbatim now, but he says something like, yeah, we do what is played on stage only off and the other way around, or something to that effect. He can look at this from both sides, not from the outside exactly, but from both sides. So yeah, great bridge, Matt. That was also going to be my next question. How do we deal with these people that are outside of the play, within the play, within the play, within the play, within the play? Have I missed a play? I think so, probably. And he's a bit of an outlier in the sense that he can, in fact, escape what, at least intellectually, what is happening around him, because he's not never really part of it. So that is very interesting. And Dreyfus has such fun with this. I love him in this. He's just, it's so beyond ham. It's not even ham anymore. It's post-ham. It's meta-ham. It's ham and eggs. It's fantastic. Toby Jones has the same part in the audio, in the radio play, and does an equally fantastic job with it. It's just a marvelous part.
I mean, for me, just like Oldman and Roth are pretty much the definitive, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, for me, Dreyfus is the definitive player. He has fun with the part. As you say, he's an Uberham, but he has both a threatening quality, which I think works extremely well, because he is not at risk of losing his head, because he's not a character, he's the player. And a player might play death, but they don't die on stage. So there's the threatening quality, he knows something they don't know, that is really quite ominous, but at the same time, there's also, especially towards the end, a beautiful how should I put this? Gentle sympathy for them. He cannot change what they are. They are characters. They are fated by what is written, but he can feel sorry for them. And I think that, for me, works really well. It's also where the play and the film, they're funny, but I also have to say I find them quite poignant when done well. And I think the film definitely has that. And that poignancy for me is especially there in the interplay between the player and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, which is interesting because the film ends with the players packing up. The players packing up their cart, closing the doors, and the play is over. It's ended. And the version that I have, the written play by Tom Stoppard, which is not the film, ends with Horatio's monologue, right? And that fades out into nothingness as signifying the end of Hamlet and therefore the end of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and therefore the end of the play. So it's an interesting choice that Stoppard makes to say, this film is going to end with the players packing up, which also brings into question the whole of what we've just seen in terms of the reality of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern themselves, their existence or their consciousness, if you like.
And there's a radio play as well, you know, that does yet another version and literally fades out just the sound of the last monologue. So here they have to solve it, obviously, by what you hear and what you slowly stop hearing. And then I think music comes in. So I think it has a different effect in all different versions, for sure.
I think that's where, for me, to some extent, while I really like the film version, I think Rosencrantz and Guildenstern it's basically the play is a creature of the stage. And I think to some extent it works best on stage because it really plays with this difference between what is a character and what is an actor, who has agency, who doesn't have agency. Because the player, at some point, you know, they ask him, have you been here before? And he says, many times. And I think that's exactly it. You know, in a production of Hamlet or of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, they will perform this over and over and over again. It's basically they're in a loop. That's what acting is. That's what stage productions are like. But at the same time, the characters, for them, it's the first time and they die, and they die the only time. It's the actors who come back. So I think for me, what the film does there at the end could almost loop back to the beginning, you know, where they will again encounter Rosencrantz and Guildenstern when it's time for the next performance. And that is something that I think is inherent in the stage, but not in film to the same extent. That's why I just think some of the metaphysics and some of the metatheater, obviously, work better on stage.
I want to also argue for the radio play very much. So obviously I haven't seen it in a stage version yet, and I would like to. Our school is actually putting up a production of the play next month. I'm not involved, but another colleague of mine is putting it on with his group of students. I'm very curious to see also how that works for, you know, a student play, if it does, because it's so, you know, philosophical, intellectual, meta theater. Is it going to work out? But I really enjoyed just listening to the text read by great actors, because you get so much more out of this text. I always thought both the film, even the text on the page, somehow I didn't quite get into it. I didn't get, you know, I was distracted by things, either by my not understanding or by the visuals of the film, maybe by the actors. But just listening to the jokes, the references to Hamlet, the excerpts from it, the way that the change is also obviously supported by sound effects going from one place to another, I think it's a great, very, very dense text that is funny, that doesn't open up like I felt at the beginning, and is really, I was surprised how much it profits from the format of a radio play. How much deeper I got into the mood, the wit, the meaning or lack thereof of the play, thanks to that version. So I'm very glad I've also seen it, or not seen it, heard it.
I think so, because I think there is a humanity to Stoppard's play, to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, that risks getting lost between the pages, between the lines, because it's so dense and it's really quite complicated and overcomplicated. And we have the law of probability and 1 million monkeys thrown 1 million times. The script of, oh, what was it again? Hamlet. If the laws of chance, the laws of statistics were still working, which they in this play are not, which was, I thought, a great gag. I don't know why I'm always so in love with gags like these nerdy little nerd gags. I love it. Anyway, the freedom, I think, of the play also comes from understanding its humanity. I had a little clip on YouTube, not the whole play, sadly, but a little clip of Benedict Cumberbatch having a go at the bit where he philosophizes whether it would be better to be dead and buried in a box or alive buried in a box, which is extremely morbid. And he gives this a sort of an almost panicked finality, like, okay, even in the worst of the worst case where I'm boxed in, metaphorically speaking, by this play that is bringing me into a direction which is to die, would I still prefer to live? He gives that a poignancy that Gary Oldman is very stoic about, almost Epicurean, a very dry sort of meditation on, does it even matter after you're dead? Because you would be dead, wouldn't you? So it depends also on whose hands it's in as a storyteller, as an actor. But if the humanity of this gets lost entirely, I don't think you can follow the play properly anymore because it's lost its bearings. I don't know if you agree with me or that you think its cleverness works well on its own, but that's how I feel about it.
I would definitely totally agree with you. It's also, I think, existentialism doesn't work for me as an intellectual exercise. It only works if there's a conviction behind it. Obviously, you can also do Beckett without having an existentialist vein in your body, but I think you're not going to do it justice. I think the humanity comes from kind of raging against feeling that you have no agency. And if you don't believe that, you're not going to do it credibly. So I think that feeling, I can't do anything because it's all determined, it's all written, it's all in the hand of someone else. You need to believe in that to bring out the emotions. And I think the film definitely does.
Otherwise, I think it would be off-putting, right? I think if the play just continued in that clever intellectual fashion only, and you didn't relate to the fate, the tragic comedy or comic tragedy of those two figures stuck in that play. Because a lot is, as you said at the beginning, is the knowledge about what's going to happen and an audience who's familiar at least with a bit of Hamlet and how it turns out. If those characters were just literally, you know, without humanity or wit or warmth, I think you would not care. At the same time, their interchangeable identities is interesting, right? Because I think we project also a lot in each of them. I guess we're also caught up in these games that they play, figuring out who they are, because we want to know, right? We want to know A is A and B is B. It confuses us terribly if suddenly Rosencrantz is Guildenstern, vice versa. That was so interesting in the radio play as well, when they, I think, changed voices like halfway through. Like different people were playing the roles or were speaking the roles. So there's different ways of doing that. But at the same time, this exercise in wit alone wouldn't work. I think I was put off, obviously, by the text on the page, but I was not put off by actors playing the roles and speaking, living the text. So that there must be something to it.
You touched on a very cute point. Hamlet, so Hamlet itself, Shakespeare's Hamlet, also can't tell them apart. So when they get to Elsinore, the queen doesn't quite know who is who, and the king obviously doesn't know who is who. And it really doesn't matter which is which, or if they themselves know which is which, right? And if you've sat through, if you are one of the very few people who have sat through the, I think, almost four-hour Kenneth Branagh version, there they are a comedic duo as well. So in a serious tragic play, so the Shakespeare play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are a comic duo, and they are interchangeable.
In this conversation, and I don't think I've thought of this before, but in this conversation, I'm suddenly thinking that to some extent, what happens in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, the going from comedy to tragedy to poignancy, actually reminds me of another Shakespeare play, namely Midsummer Night's Dream, where you've got Pyramus and Thisbe. And Pyramus and Thisbe, again, a play within a play. You've got actors who are basically making a mess of a play. It is comedic, it is farcical, but in all the good productions I've seen of it, there comes a moment when it switches within one or two lines from comedy to actually poignancy, where basically Pyramus is dead. Sorry, spoiler for a very old play here. And Thisbe, who's played by a man who's playing a woman who did not want to play a woman, but has kind of accepted, well, I guess this is what I play because I've got a high voice. And obviously you've got a lot of the kind of cross-dressing humor before that. But then suddenly in that moment, in, as I said, the good productions that I've seen, Thisbe becomes real in the sense that her mourning becomes real. It's still, obviously, it's a play, and it's a play within a play, and it's a man playing a woman. So to some extent, you're not watching Thisbe, you're watching an actor. But you are watching Thespian. I think, again, that's where it comes in, what I said before that. I think to some extent, the double layers, triple layers that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern play with and how that basically affects its humanity have something to do very kind of intrinsically with the stage to me. It's someone can be on stage and we recognize they're an actor. We recognize they're not the character, but they are the character. They're both at the same time. And I think film can do that, but it's just, it's not as typical of film. In a stage play, someone can just put on a new costume and they're a new character. If in film, someone puts on a new costume, we assume it's the old character just wearing new clothes.
Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of really beautiful moments like these in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead as well. I'm thinking of the death. Don't know if you want to spoil it, but there's a death scene at the end with a fake dagger and a death that is so well acted. And then it turns out, you know, is it fake? Is it not? But I think earlier on, the player also tells the story of the man they were able to hang on stage in one of their plays. And the audience wasn't aware, you know, suspension of disbelief. That's, I think, the joke on the words there. That the guy is actually hanged on stage. And he goes on to describe that the way he died was not very realistic. You know, the actual death, people didn't believe that that was very well played, even though it was an actual death. And I think that also is a joke on the one hand, but at the same time, I think it cuts to a lot of reality as well, right? So the way we see death portrayed in films and plays, the way we expect someone to die, how close is that to reality? And when we see an actual death, you know, do we feel that that looks like real? I mean, there's such an interesting thing about perception and acting, good acting versus reality, bad acting. Can that be reality? I thought this goes a lot into what you said about Pyramus and Thisbe with these layers that are put in front of you and you don't know what's real. And the real thing might look fake and vice versa.
And there's a lot of that in Shakespeare anyway, not just Midsummer Night's Dream, but if I remind you of the beginning of Henry V with the fabulous chorus in that film, again, a Shakespeare film, we have somebody walking backstage of a movie set, for instance, instead of a stage. So it plays with that, and Shakespeare's plays within plays and stories within stories. Well, I can't read Mr. Shakespeare's mind, but he seems to really love that sort of thing.
All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. I think, you know, he loved that metaphor and Stoppard loves picking it up and running with it.
Yeah, exactly. I was wondering, the film is a 1990 film. It's quite old. How did you think it aged? Watching it now in 2026 and after Stoppard's death?
For me, it has aged well because, as I said, I don't read this production as political in that sense, but metaphysical, and the metaphysics have not changed. It is, I mean, you look at the film and just the quality of the image, you know, it's 1990s, but I don't see what a current production could do very differently or better. I do think it shows that Stoppard, while he had a lot of good ideas that also work well on film, he is not a seasoned film director. So I think there is a certain clunkiness to it as a film at times where it feels like, you know, this should be on stage and it still works on film, but it should be on stage. So I don't think the time difference makes a huge difference to me, but I wonder how Stoppard would have continued as a film director if he had made more films. I think he's done a very good start with this one, but it is his first film and I do think it shows a tiny bit.
I think for me, the only timely thing that I could detect about the film was the age of the actors that are well known. Like I said, you know, seeing Gary Oldman somewhere between Sid and Nancy and Bram Stoker's Dracula was interesting. And Tim Roth as well. I have never seen a role where he was actually an attractive character, you know, in that sense. Like he was very charismatic in that role, I thought. Very like mysterious. And Gary Oldman obviously was always great in anything I've seen him in. Also Ian Glen was so good as Hamlet. And I just literally know him from that Game of Thrones role. And it's of questionable acting, you know, quality or demand. But he was really convincing in the way he portrayed that despair and determination. Anyway, that's the only way I could tell, okay, this movie is from 1990, even though I knew. Apart from that, I didn't really think about it. Like you said, Matt, it's I think I refer it more to Hamilton Shakespeare. That's why it's, you know, my point of reference is not when the movie was made, but rather, okay, just refers back to Shakespeare's time somehow in terms of the costumes and the locations and so on. It's certainly an interesting mix.
Though if they did do a remake, I think Gary Oldman should play the player.
After Slow Horses, that would be wonderful. I think it shows its age a little bit in terms of it is a bit stagey. It's intrinsic in the material. And maybe had Stoppard waited a couple of years, he could give it a bit more freedom. I think it deserves that. Otherwise, this will be the hill. I will defend this film, even if the critics didn't really, when it came out, didn't really receive it with open arms, let's say.
Well, some of them just didn't get it. I'm sorry, Mr. Ebert, but you did not get it.
Yeah, I've written about this before. I don't agree with him either. He says the film is dead as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Wow. How meta is that?
Which is very meta and also, I think, not entirely fair. But I think for me, it holds up in terms of that it is a lovely thing and it is what it is. And if it feels a little bit dated, then that's fine. Mr. Branagh is not as young as he once was either. And he still made Henry V and Hamlet and looks young in that one as well. The really long one where he has this weird blonde hairdo and little goatee and everybody's really fabulous in it and it goes on way too long.
Oh yeah, that one. No, I mean, and Stoppard won, you know, the Golden Lion in Venice and Dreyfus won in Venice as well. So, I mean, it was well regarded at the time, even though not all critics were equally enthusiastic or got it equally well. So I think that must have also been, you know, quite surprising at the time for Stoppard to make this, not being a filmmaker normally and then getting, you know, the grand prize basically at the Venice Film Festival. Surprising that he didn't go on with more of his own filmmaking after this.
Yeah, and the play is from 1966. It was one of his first successes as a playwright. So it was already old when it was filmed, right? So it goes way back. Well, you're right, Sam. Not everybody was as snooty as Mr. Ebert was about a show. That's true. So I'm going to ask you if you have any fantastic final thoughts. I'm not going to ask you for famous last words because, you know, if things are written, you have to really be careful with that sort of thing.
I was thinking of maybe favorite lines, you know, lines that stuck out to us. There was one line that I listened to today in the rest of the radio play where I can't quote it like word by word, but it struck me as something. When once it was out, it was about, you know, once you take the subjective view of one person and then you take the next one and you take the next one and at the end it's spread so thin that it's reality. And that was a line that just struck me. I was like, wow, exactly, that's really such a spot on way of putting that what we live through, especially in the present day and age as well, right? What is reality and which corner are you in, which camp are you in, how do you see the world? And I thought that was such a poetic way of putting that. Spread so thin and you expect something, you know, negative, but then you come up with, okay, then that's reality. So my favorite line, maybe.
Beautiful. I love almost all of it. But I think something that's telling about the play itself is a really rather lovely line where they almost are to be executed. And then comes the line, there had to be some point somewhere at the beginning where we could have said no. I always sort of love that thing because I'm like, yes, but if you had, you wouldn't have had a little bit of life that you did in between the pages of Shakespeare's Hamlet. So is that really what you would have opted for if you did have the choice? I think that's a really sort of telling line and typical of Stoppard, who is, to me, seems he has such huge heart for the human condition. Matt, any famous last word, famous lines?
I mean, there's so many lines that I love in this play and in the film. So I'm actually going to go with something that's without words. I love the scene where the players rehearse the play within the play in the tavern. And it's all stagecraft and magic. You've got the actors playing the boat and the ocean and the waves. And in the end, there's two of them basically that are still left on stage. And I think Guildenstern asks, what about them? And the two of them are obviously Rosencrantz and Guildenstern within the play. And the player just says, they're dead. And then we see them basically getting hanged. Fake hanged because they're actors, because it's a stage play. But it's just, it's such a wonderful encapsulation. So while I think Stoppard, perhaps he could have grown as a movie director, and this was obviously his first film, he still knew how to stage things. And that is, for me, a perfect encapsulation of how well he stages this.
Oh, that's beautiful, beautiful scene. Like the shadow plays and the puppet plays. It's so beautifully done. Guys, I think that's that. I want to thank you so much for showing up for this and being able to pick your brain on what might prima facie not be a very difficult play, but maybe it sort of kind of is. And to talk about Tom Stoppard, who will be dearly missed because of brilliant mind. And I want to thank our listener for bearing with us in this existential little journey through Tom Stoppard's play and film. So thank you very much. And I hope to see you next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.